It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, since COVID-19 rolled into Iowa back in March, about 1,000 registered child care centers in our state have shut down. That's according to Iowa Department of Human Services data from late last month. However, even before COVID-19, Iowa was experiencing a child care crisis of sorts. So this virus has made it even worse. And now, as the state begins to reopen and parents return to work, some are struggling more than ever to find affordable, quality child care. Perhaps this describes your situation. This hour, we want to get several perspectives on the problem from the owners of child care centers, from Iowa legislators as well, and from you, our listeners. Do you depend on child care during this pandemic? Are you searching, perhaps struggling, to find child care so that you and your spouse, your partner, can return to work? Tell us your experience. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Joining me, first of all, is Vicki Brandenburg. Vicki is the owner of Lionheart Early Learning Center in Iowa City. Welcome to our program, Vicki.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, start off by telling us about Lionheart Early Learning Center in normal times. And we should perhaps from the outset say that you're a registered center. There are different categories of child care. And so you are a registered center with the state. You can take from 20 to 100 children. Is that right?
On our normal day, we have about 125 children. We're licensed for 160 children.
Mm-hmm.
But on the average day, we have about 125.
Okay, so in normal times, before this broke loose with COVID-19, 125 enrollment. Take us back to March. What happened when the virus struck, from your perspective, at Lionheart Early Learning Center?
Yeah, so St. Patrick's Day is when it really became real for us. We had an employee who had a possible positive screening and notified us that they were going through the screening process. So we notified the families in our care, so they were informed of our situation.
Mm-hmm.
Several of the families came to pick up early that day and said they were going to be out for a while. Then the next day, the number grew to 6 employees, parents, or children that all had positive screenings. So we made the decision at that time that we needed to close our center. So we closed for 2 weeks so we could give everyone some time to isolate and try to reassess our situation. We did reopen after that 2 weeks. Many of our parents are essential workers, so we knew we had to get back open to get those children back into care. So we reopened, and we have been running with about 30 to 35 children a day since that time.
Mm-hmm. And that reopening would have been, what, the end of March, beginning of April?
Yes, yeah, so we opened April 4th.
Okay. So 30-some enrolled, down from 125 kids prior to this
right.
virus crisis. What about the staff? You have over 20 staff members, I understand. How has this impacted your staff?
So we normally have about 45 staff on schedule, whether it's full-time or part-time. So when that happened, all of our employees were paid for that 2 week time that we closed. But once we reopened, most of our families were staying home. Some of them are paying a holding fee to keep their place.
Mm.
Some people have pulled out completely. So they're no longer using care at all. So they're not paying any tuition. So at that point, then we knew we had to lay off some employees. So we laid off about 25 employees once we knew how many children we were going to have in care.
25 employees lost their jobs. I imagine that was very hard news to deliver to your staff members.
It was a horrible moment. I thought the day that I had to close the center and we made that decision, I thought that was the worst day that I was going to have to have as an owner. But the day that I knew I had to lay off employees was absolutely heart-wrenching.
Yeah. In the CARES Act, there are PPP loans meant to protect payrolled employees. Did you apply? Did you receive? Did that work out in any way?
Yeah, that was a difficult process. The bank we were working with was, holding funds and not processing loans. So we did eventually find a company to do our PPP loan. We were approved for it, so we recently received those funds. So we've been bringing employees back. But the stipulation on the PPP loan is that you spend 75% of that money on payroll within 8 weeks. And there's only 3 pay periods in that 8 weeks for us. So we anticipate we're going to have to pay some of that money back because we're just not going to be able to spend it fast enough.
Mm-hmm. But it's been useful to a certain extent in holding people, staff members, keeping staff members aside from the 25 you had to lay off in place and working.
Yes, so with those funds, we're going to be able to bring everyone back to work.
Okay, but then the question is, how many kids do you have from that original 25? Some of them, as you said, the holding fee, they chose not to pay for that. Do you foresee that, depending on the length of this crisis, you can bounce back to your full numbers prior to this crisis?
It's a very real concern for us. My worry is that we're going to bring employees back and the children won't come back to the center also. So I'm concerned that I'll have this money now to pay these employees, but if the families don't return, I'll have to lay people off once again. And my fear is that those will become a permanent layoff.
Mm-hmm. Describe some of the extra safety precautions you employ now. Part of getting your business back is going to be to demonstrate to parents that you are taking the utmost in safety precautions, not allowing the disease to be transmitted within your walls.
Yeah, so when parents drop off to us, we've changed our whole procedure for that drop-off. So they come in, we have a set of double doors. So they bring the children into that set of double doors. We check their temperature. They take off their shoes. And then they come through, they say goodbye to their parent. They'll come through the next set of doors. A teacher will take them to a hand washing sink so they can wash their hands. And then they take them to their classroom to put on their school shoes, the shoes that will remain at the center so we don't have to worry about COVID being tracked in on shoes.
Mm. Okay.
Employees have masks that they can use, but we have found that masks are very scary to children and especially, very young children just don't understand that. So most of the employees have opted to not wear masks because it's just too upsetting for those children.
And you don't think it's a matter of time that the kids, no matter, a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old, that it takes some explaining. They don't get used to it. We have in society, right. I find them also distressing, as I imagine most people do, a supermarket full of masked people. But we humans are adaptable. You don't think that can happen with kids as well?
Children rely on your facial expressions. When they can only see your eyes and your forehead, it's very difficult for them to read adults. So they really rely heavily on those facial expressions and those cues. So it makes it very difficult to communicate with young children, in particular infants and toddlers. They need the sound of your voice, but they need to be able to see your face.
Mm-hmm.
So older children, like 4 and 5-year-olds, school-age children, they can adapt to that. Many of them understand why we're wearing masks. They've heard it from their families. But those younger children just don't understand that.
If you've just joined us, Vicki Brandenburg is with me now, owner of Lionheart Early Learning Center in Iowa City. We're talking about child care providers in the time of COVID. And if you were hearing earlier, Vicki's center has really been devastated by this virus. Prior to the virus rolling across Iowa, they looked after over 125 kids, over 40 staff members to do that. Now their numbers right around the 30 to 40 range with the kids, had to lay off 25 of her staff members. Let's also talk with Representative Tracy Ellert. Tracy Ellert, welcome to our program.
Hi, welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yes, you are a state representative. We're pleased to have you on here, Representative Ellert from Cedar Rapids. You're a Democrat, but let me set your legislator's side hat to the side, if I may, for the moment, because you also own a child care program in Cedar Rapids. You have for over 10 years. Tell us about your business. Run us through what has happened to your business in this time of COVID.
Sure. So my business used to be ran year-round until I got elected to the legislature. Since that time, I have ran a summer day camp program. So I've only been open in the summer until this year. This year with COVID-19, my program did open early. We opened the week after the legislative session was suspended. I don't have a calendar in front of me, so I don't know exactly what date that was, but March 20-something. Mm-hmm. I thought maybe we'd just be open for a couple weeks and we would take our school-age kids that typically come to our summer program, and then, you know, things would go back to normal and then I'd reopen again on June 1st. But as we know, things, you know, haven't been able to go back to normal yet. So we've remained open and we will remain open till the end of summer, assuming school starts back up like normal. I've had to do a lot of the same things that Vicki's done. We're doing the temperature checks at the door. We've always been a shoe-free classroom, so shoes are still being removed right when they come in. Parents are expected to stay right at the door, drop off, and then leave and not enter the classroom. We've also been making sure that we're staying in contact with parents as to where, you know, where they're going outside of work. Are they taking their children out in public settings? Because that is potentially a hazard for all the other families in our classroom and my family as well when I go back to my family at the end of the day. So also adding extra communication with families. I too also, like Vicki, experienced the drop in numbers. Now I'm a registered child development home, a category B, so I'm licensed for 12. Mm-hmm. I typically have 8 children enrolled, and that's what I would have had this summer. It's also what I had on March 17th when we decided to open the program back up early. I was supposed to have 8 attend. By that Monday when we opened up, I was down to 3 children because families have either been laid off or they were allowed to work from home. And they said, you know, I'm just going to attempt to get some work done while my kids are here. I just consider it too much of a risk right now to take them anywhere. So we had 3 kids. Since that time, I have picked up my nephew. He's needed childcare because the center that he goes to dropped in numbers. Also, they wanted families coming only if they were working from home. They didn't want those families coming. And my sister sometimes has the option to stay at home. So she has been bringing him to my program, so I've got him. And then we did have another one that started back up last week as their family increased work hours. So now we have anywhere from 3 to 5 a day rather than our 8. And so far for summer, it looks like that's what our enrollment may be. I keep checking in with our families that were supposed to be here for summer, and their workplaces are just not letting them know yet if they'll be returning to work or if they're going to continue having them work from home. So some have even been told they may be working from home the rest of the year. Some it's been the rest of the summer. So I'm anticipating lower numbers at least through summer, if not the remainder of the year.
Representative Ellert, how has your business been holding up from a financial point of view?
Well, so I have a little bit more of a unique situation because I was still being paid by the state for my legislative position. So I didn't really let my income from the childcare affect things. I had all essential employees for families that really needed care. So when my budget ran over, I just pulled from my legislative income. Well, that's going to be dwindling off. So now I really do have to pay attention to the budget. And if, you know, we don't get help soon, that could potentially affect things and I might have to reconsider remaining open.
Well, if you've just joined us, Representative Tracy Ellert is with us. She is a child care center owner, also a state representative from Cedar Rapids, a Democrat. We'll also have a Republican join us now, Representative Ann Meyer, state representative from Fort Dodge. Welcome to you, Representative Meyer.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me, Ben.
I wanted to ask both of you legislators to, Tracy Ellert put on her legislator hat. I asked her to take it off just a moment ago and ask you to how do you see this as a legislator? Representative Meyer, your party has control of both chambers in the Iowa legislature. Tell us what your thoughts are when you hear the crisis affecting child care, an area where we had problems already here in the state.
Well, I'll talk about just being a legislator from a party view. We never viewed this as a party issue. This is not a Democrat or Republican issue. It's an issue throughout the state that before the COVID crisis hit, it's been a priority of the House to work on safe and affordable access to child care. So, again, apart from party, it's been a priority for all of us to mm-hmm. work on the access to it. Listening to your story from Iowa City that Vicki spoke about, since we've been home, I've been focused on constituent issues and the child care issues in our county in Fort Dodge. We have a very similar story. One of our larger centers, it is licensed for 200 kids. And since the crisis started, she's lost 80 spots. She hasn't lost 80 spots. She's lost 80 kids in the census started back in March. And she's had to lay off people as well. She did have access to a PPP loan, which she did apply for and receive. So that's been a help to her, also bringing people back on. A lot of the essential workers some of our workers are going back, so she's going to start to get more children in. But Representative Ellert and I were also involved in the DHS CARES Act, the money that's coming in through the feds to support child care sustainability. So there are some things coming that will be dispersed by the state that will help keep these child care centers open, hopefully. Mm-hmm. I talked to our expert in Fort Dodge. She doesn't see any changes. We were about 1,400 spots short in Fort Dodge of child care. We expect that, unfortunately, we're still going to have that need once everyone goes back to work. And we're expecting everyone will go back to work within the next few months.
Okay. Representative Meyer, thank you very much. I want to turn back to our first guest who joined us, Vicki Brandenburg, owner of Lionheart Early Learning Center in Iowa City. We'll be saying goodbye to you in a few minutes when we take a break. So I wanted to make sure I get this question to you, Vicki. What are your thoughts on how the state of Iowa is reacting in regards to child care centers, your situation, what's working, what's not, in your point of view?
From a center perspective, we haven't heard anything from the state of Iowa. They've sent out a memo that they were going to help us source some supplies such as disinfectants, paper towels, that sort of thing. But other than that, we really haven't heard anything. When I was making the decision if I should close my center, my licensing consultant was very supportive, but, you know, she didn't really have a lot of information at that time herself, and we didn't hear anything from Des Moines to say, you know, this is a good protocol for you to have in place. And truthfully, we felt like we were floundering, and many of the programs around me, you know, we contacted one another to say, what are you going to do? Hoping collectively we could come up with a plan of what we needed to do, but we just didn't hear anything from Des Moines. And you know, other states have initiatives coming out that are already out to their programs. You know, their programs are being paid for that lost revenue based on their attendance from February. Childcare providers in centers and homes are being paid a stipend, you know, kind of as a hazard pay. We're not seeing that from Iowa, and I'm hoping it's in the works, but, you know, at this point, we just haven't heard that. So okay. I'm hopeful that Iowa is going to take a look at what other centers are, or other states are doing, and are going to really step forward to be able to help childcare industry. But today, it doesn't feel like they are.
I want to make sure our legislators know that they'll be able to respond to what you just said, Vicki, after the break. We're coming up on a break, and as I said, we're going to be saying goodbye to you, Vicki, before we go in the final minute. Do you hope or think this will cause a rethinking of reimbursement for childcare in the state, the problems, the concerns you had prior to this crisis?
You know, I'm hopeful that childcare as a whole is going to really become out there in the forefront. But, you know, over the years, childcare has been neglected. So I'm not very optimistic that there's going to be any real hard and fast changes. You know, as a whole, we need to look at the cost of childcare. It's a very low profit margin to operate a childcare center, a lot of risk involved in it. And it's very costly for parents. And truthfully, parents just cannot pay more than what they're already paying. So, you know, we need to, as a nation, take a look at what we're going to do about early childhood and how we're going to make that affordable for all families.
Vicki Brandenburg, thank you very much. We wish your center, Lionheart Early Learning Center in Iowa City, all the best in getting back on its feet, as many businesses are off their feet during this COVID crisis. We appreciate your time, Vicki Brandenburg.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll spend about 10 minutes with Representatives Tracy Ellert and Representative Ann Meyer to get their response to what Vicki had to say. And then we'll move on to talk about Report for America, that journalism project. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay with us. Back in just a moment. We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking most of this hour about how the COVID crisis has caused a further crisis in finding affordable, quality child care for Iowans. Still with us, two legislators, Representatives Ann Meyer of Fort Dodge and Tracy Ellert of Cedar Rapids, who happens also to be a child care center owner. Let's finish up our conversation. Let me just throw out this email from one of our listeners before we do. A listener from Iowa City writes, I am a working professional single mother with a four-year-old with full custody. I have found single parenting has been left out of the conversation. We have to work. There is no one else but our children come first. What are we supposed to do as this new reality will be in place for months? I make too much money for any assistance, but not enough to go half-time or pay all the bills while also paying for child care. So in the time we have left, let's respond to that, as well as the concerns that Vicki mentioned in our first half hour. Representative Ellert, may I ask you to go first?
Sure. So in regards to the email that was sent, this is something that we've been working on in the House because this is an issue not just for single parents, but all parents. Child care is just not affordable, but at the same time, our child care and early ed workforce is barely making minimum wage in most cases. So it's really something that is a continuous conversation, and we did put a little work in the House this year, passed some bills, But then the session got suspended, and I'm hoping when we go back, we can get those bills over to the Senate. It'll start addressing some of those issues. But again, it's just a small dent and a big problem that we're very much aware of. As far as Vicky's comments from earlier, I've been hearing that same thought from providers across the state, that they just feel like they were left with little guidance. They weren't hearing enough from the state. And she's not sure if help's coming. Well, the Federal CARES Act did provide an additional $3.5 billion in discretionary funding for the Child Care and Development Block Grant. And on April 14th, Iowa did receive their portion of that. That funding here in Iowa is intended to serve two key purposes, and that's to support members of the essential workforce, irrespective of income, through child care assistance, and also to assist child care providers to remain open or reopen if they did have to close. And that'll be whether those providers and programs serve child care assistance families or not. I was hoping that the plan would have been released. It was supposed to be released this morning, and I was hoping to be able to talk about some of the details in it. Mm-hmm. But since it has not been publicly released yet, I can't really go into too much detail, but I will say the most recent version that is ready to be released is better than the original. It's going to help some programs quite a bit more than we originally thought.
Representative Meyer, chime in here with your views.
Yes, like Representative Ellard said, we did pass, the workforce is a big issue. We've noticed with prior to the COVID crisis, with our low unemployment rate, workers could go to a gas station and make more money than they could be making with your child. So that was definitely an issue we all wanted to address. Representative Eller mentioned that those bills made it through the House with complete bipartisan support, raising provider rates. Mm-hmm. We did get one subcommittee through the Senate before we suspended session. And I'm since this was a priority in the House, I think that this is legislation that we're going to be able to work through with the Senate and hopefully get passed in the Senate and then on to the governor's desk, because Representative Eller's right. Provider rates definitely have to go up. As far as the CARES Act, there were a few changes that were made since we did get the original draft, and I believe that we are, as the state, are contacting the centers to dispense that money, but we mm-hmm. haven't been given exact.
Right. So, Representative Meyer, just respond to Vicky Brandenburg's dissatisfaction with the state giving her guidance in the early days of this coronavirus outbreak.
Well, I did not get that from the Fort Dodge area. Again, working with our early childhood expert, they came to me and I was definitely able to give them guidance. So I'm not sure where the breakdown of communication was there. However, DHS made the guidance available on their website almost immediately. Now, I'm not a child care provider, so Representative Eller could speak to that, but the guidance for child care centers was put out pretty early.
Anything to add to that? We're running out of time. We're moving on to another conversation in about 5 minutes. But Representative Eller, anything before a couple of concluding questions to add to what your colleague there mentioned?
So DHS did post guidance right away, but it was more, here's some guidelines you can choose to follow. This is what we would like you to follow, but it's not mandatory. Programs were looking for a very much set in stone. This is the process you need to follow. This is what you need to do if there's an outbreak. And it was very loose, and it was being handled differently in different areas. They also wanted to hear more about how soon will we be getting financial support? And that's the part that I think was really dropped, is they were not receiving anything about financial relief, which is what most of them are waiting for.
Right. Okay. Very quickly, a couple of questions. Please respond to these. What challenges specifically do you see in the coming weeks as our state tries to open up? We have the majority of counties since May 1st relaxing a little bit in the restrictions, if I can put it that way. Representative Meyer, what do you see as concerns, things that really have to be handled adroitly in the coming weeks?
So not in respects to childcare, but just in case that this crisis does recur in the fall, or any crisis reoccurs where we have to close down schools, we probably need to put some exact guidelines in place how we're going to handle that. So that's one of the things that we're looking at is if this should reoccur, since this was really unprecedented, we didn't really have a lot of concrete rules to go by. So we're looking at putting some guidelines in place for the future.
Okay. And Representative Ellert, in the last minute of our conversation, what do you see going forward?
I absolutely agree with Representative Meyer. We need to have some guidelines. I also work in one of the public schools in my house district, and especially around education. There was so many questions around education, and not just the early ed setting like childcare. And we also need to think about how we're going to bring back all our workers safely and make sure that they remain safe.
Okay. Thank you very much for this conversation, Representatives Tracy Ellert of Cedar Rapids, a Democrat, Representative Ann Meyer, a state representative from Fort Dodge, a Republican. We appreciate you coming on our program. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We want to spend the final 10 minutes or so of the program talking about a project called Report for America. It's new, so don't feel bad if you've never heard about it. It was just launched in 2017. Report for America is a national service program that places journalists into local newsrooms to report on undercovered issues and communities. And it does this through what is its group of reporting, a reporting corps, like the Peace Corps, a group of people. This is an initiative of the nonprofit news organization, the Ground Truth Project. And last month, Report for America announced the selection of 222 journalists for this year's reporting corps. They will be placed with more than 160 local news organizations in 46 states, also in Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, one also here in Iowa, at Iowa Public Radio. Imagine that. On June 1st, Cassidy Arena will join our ranks, covering the Iowa State House for Iowa Public Radio, focusing on undercovered issues of interest to our booming Latino population here in Iowa. And in a coming River to River, we will definitely talk more than once with our colleague. She will join us June 1st, as I mentioned, Cassidy Arena. But first, let's learn more about this overall program from Rachel Rohr. She is Director of Training and Service for Report for America. Rachel, welcome to our program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is really neat, and we're glad that Iowa Public Radio is going to be jumping in and taking part of this rapidly expanding, worthwhile program. Tell us more about why Report for America was launched and its mission.
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, we're a national service program. So the vision here is really that local journalism is a public service. So we are donor financed. And one of our goals is to create a sustainable system to provide Americans with the information they need to improve their communities, hold powerful institutions accountable, and also rebuild trust in the media. And so Report for America actually supports a portion of the salaries of our core members. So as you mentioned, 225 reporters that are going to be based in more than 160 newsrooms for 2020. So we provide half the salary, up to $20,000 per core member. And we also work with the local newsrooms to help the local newsrooms raise their portion of the remainder of the salary. And so for nonprofit and public media organizations like Iowa Public Radio, I know perhaps need a little less help in that department. These are newsrooms that are very familiar with philanthropy as a way to support local journalism that the public needs. But for for-profit newsrooms, for newspapers. This can be a really valuable way to help the newsroom become more sustainable and to diversify that revenue so that we can continue to have local journalists covering these really important beats. All of our Report for America core members are covering undercovered issues and communities. We ask the newsrooms when they apply to host a core member to really look at the coverage in their area and determine what are the most pressing coverage gaps, what really needs to get covered that not only is their newsroom not really covering sufficiently, but any newsroom in the region. And so we select those newsrooms based on the strength of those beats that they create to fill those coverage gaps. And then we have a very competitive application process to match wonderful emerging journalists into those positions. We had more than 1,800 applications for the program this year.
Mm-hmm. So, as I mentioned in our case, Iowa's population is overwhelmingly white, more than 90% Caucasian, but we also have a vibrant, booming Latino population in places like West Liberty. So, give us a sense of some of the other, what you call, undercovered issues of interest that this project is addressing, Report for America.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we hear it from newsrooms across the country that they want to make sure that the journalists who are covering their communities reflect those communities that they cover. So there has been high demand from the newsrooms we're working with to have Spanish-speaking journalists, to have journalists of color, in order to reflect the communities that they're covering and serving. So among our 225 reporters for our 2020 class, about 40% are journalists of color, and more than a quarter speak Spanish. Five are actually post-9/11 U.S. military veterans, and more than two-thirds are actually women. There are more women graduating from journalism programs these days, and many more women applied into our program. And so ultimately, our class is made up of two-thirds women.
You mentioned at the outset rebuilding trust as a goal of Report for America. Talk about how we know trust has been broken, why it's been broken, how it is to be rebuilt.
Yes, so this is, you know, such a pressing issue. As we've seen with the whole journalism industry, there has really been a collapse of the revenue models with digital advertising, really shifting the revenue so that many smaller sized news outlets have closed or have been gutted, and really across the board. And what we have found is that as the media gets concentrated on the coasts, and a lot of these smaller shops, don't have the journalists that they used to, that trust in the media has really fallen. We have a more polarized media environment, a more partisan media environment. And what we know is that people are much more likely to trust their local journalists than they are, journalists at big news organizations that really aren't necessarily listening to them. And so by supporting local journalism and covering local communities, it's a way of ensuring that information is getting to people so they can make the decisions that they need to make, and knowing that information is trustworthy. Journalists have a process of vetting and verifying information, and so it's really a great service to communities.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but talk a little bit about, and we have a few minutes left, of course, this was long in the works, a Report for America and the Ground Truth Project, established well before the current crisis. But talk a little bit, Rachel, about the unforeseen journalistic challenges posed by COVID-19.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is really such an unprecedented time that we're living in. And I think it's become clear to all of us that local journalism is more important than ever. I mean, getting local accurate information specific to our specific areas can actually be a matter of life and death. And so journalists are very much essential workers. And so the start of this program is not going to be delayed, really, as a result of COVID. It may be that moves are going to be a bit more challenging and a bit more nerve-wracking potentially, although many of our reporters actually already live in the communities that they're covering, but plenty of them will be moving. Some of them might initially be starting their reporting jobs remotely, which can be a real challenge. But, you know, in this time of COVID, like many, many industries, the journalism industry has been hit very hard financially by COVID. And so it's certainly further hurting an industry that's already quite hurt. And so this is really a tough time to be doing layoffs or furloughs, which is something that we're seeing in newsrooms. And so the encouraging thing is that we're able to place 225 reporters into local newsrooms at a time when many newsrooms are pulling or have to pull back for financial reasons. And so we know that even if a core member's beat isn't specifically covering COVID, we know that they're going to be very involved in this story, because no matter what beat you have, no matter what community or issue you're covering, this pandemic is having a huge effect. And so it's encouraging that all of these communities, these 162 newsrooms where our reporters will all be getting more information, more thorough information as a result of these core members going into these newsrooms.
Right. And as this crisis has rolled across the entire country, this has affected Cassidy Arena when she joins us here at Iowa Public Radio. She'll be covering issues related to the COVID-19 pandemic, the election, state issues through this lens of the undercovered Latino communities in Iowa. So as we know, Rachel, in journalism these days, it's not a joke, but around the newsroom, but it's hard to find something journalistically that has not been affected by the COVID crisis. So that really is the lens through which we look at almost anything we cover, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, certainly for those who were planning to have health care beef anyway, there's, you know, absolutely going to be dominated by COVID coverage. But if your beat is elections, wow, the impact that this pandemic is having on elections. If your beat is an underrepresented community that really hasn't been covered, or a neighborhood that hasn't been covered, or an entire region or county that hasn't been covered, you know, you can believe that COVID is having a tremendous impact. So really, it's going to be at the forefront, I think, of all of the coverage they're doing.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, many core members moving to a new location now. Imagine in this atmosphere, having to go to a new location, perhaps away from friends and family that you know. This is really a trying time. These are courageous core members accepting a new challenge by perhaps going to a new state, a new part of the country.
Yeah, they really are. They're a tremendous group. The average age in our core is 27. So they have some job experience. Many of them have been out of college for a little while, although we do have some recent grads. But absolutely, you got to be brave to pick up and move to a brand new place and start a brand new beat. And the encouraging thing is not only have our newsrooms really stepped up to welcome these core members and help them get settled, but we had our first welcome call on Sunday night to get all of them together. And it was really wonderful to see the outpouring of support to each other. You know, oh, you've never been to Texas and that's where you're going. You know, I've always lived in Texas and I can, you know, connect you with people. So that was really wonderful to see. You know, they're going to also help each other get settled.
Right. And it's amazing to think, Rachel, that Report for America was just launched in 2017. And this is a huge leap in the growth of this reporting core of Report for America. In the final minute we have of the program, tell us about where this program, this project, hopes to go in the future. What is the vision?
Yes, we've been growing very quickly, and we do hope to keep growing. And I know that, you know, with the COVID-19 pandemic, it's clear that fundraising could be more challenging than it has been in years past, but we're confident that we can continue to scale the program. Our current year class, we started with 61, and of course, we're growing to 225. The ultimate goal is to get to 1,000. We'll see if we get there. It will certainly take a few years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And as you said, too, this is donor financed. Anything to add to that? So these are just individual givers or specific corporations, or where is this money primarily coming from?
You know, it's a range. A lot of the funding that Report for America is using to help pay these salaries is coming from large foundations, even some tech money. The funds that the local newsrooms use to match the salary often come from small donors, individual donors, crowdsourcing, right, even crowdfunding. But really, it's going to take a mix of really creative business models in order to sustain local journalism.
Rachel Rohr, thank you so much for joining us and telling us a little bit about Report for America. She is Director of Training and Service for Report for America. We appreciate it, Rachel. You take care.
Thanks so much, Ben. You too.
Tomorrow on the program, well, Iowa's June primaries are fast approaching. We're going to tackle those on Politics Day tomorrow. Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa joining us. Hope you'll join us too with your comments and questions. Politics Wednesday tomorrow on the program. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.